A comfortable home means different things during a Wisconsin winter as opposed to a Midwestern summer, but some of your home's design and construction elements work on your behalf all year round. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we're going to start out talking about the role of insulation and ventilation and how we can make the most of our home's ability to stay cool. John Freiberger is a Wisconsin-registered home inspector who specializes in the evaluation of older structures. He is the founder of Freiberger & Associates in Fitchburg, Wisconsin. He himself, however, is not an older structure. Hi, John. Good to see you. I almost got you with a mouthful of coffee there.
You almost did, yes. Fortunately, it stayed in my mouth.
There you go. Good to see you, as always. And Ken Adams is the owner of Adams Design Construction in Madison. He and John have been doing these programs together for quite a few years. Good to see you, Ken.
Well, it's great to be back here. Nice to see you, too.
Well, it hasn't been a very hot summer, actually, other than a little day or two here and there. But that doesn't mean that homes won't get uncomfortable when temperatures, and I would say especially humidity, rises. What role does venting, first of all, play in keeping homes cool in the summer?
Well, that's a very, very good question, and it's a wonderful question. I'd just like to back up just a little bit and talk about what happens with heat and how it transfers. And a lot of your listeners already know this, but I'm just going to put it out there because it's insulation 101.
Sure.
Heat transfers in many different ways, or three primary ways. The first one is convection. And that's when air is moved. If you have a window that's open, you have a fan in the window, you're moving air through, and that helps to move heat to cool and cool to warm. Then there's radiation, which is like electromagnetic radiation, like the sun, which is the big source of heat gain in the summertime. Mm-hmm. That's why the South is so hot, and they have to keep their houses cool using ways to move radiation out of their house. In the summertime, radiation comes into your house. It soaks. It beats down on your roof. It comes in through your windows. Heat starts to develop in your attic, and you use ventilation to remove that heat. And ventilation comes in from the lower part of the roof typically, and as it heats, it rises and goes out at the peak of the roof or thereabouts. That's the simple explanation. Then the third one is conduction. And conduction is, you're laying in bed on a warm night and your spouse puts their cold foot on your thigh and you jump out of bed screaming. That's the transference of heat through different materials, shall we say.
I didn't see that example coming. I'll give you that, Ken.
Heating a frying pan, that sort of thing. So these are basically three different way processes of moving heat back and forth, and they demand sort of mildly different ways of looking at how you're going to attack mm-hmm. problems that they create. With regard to convection, probably the simplest thing to do is to make sure you seal up your gaps, you know, mm-hmm. you make sure air doesn't move through the walls, through the windows. In the summertime, it's closing the windows and turning the AC on. You're keeping the air in the house comfortable, mm-hmm. and you're not running your air conditioner with your windows open. You know what I mean? For radiation, the best thing to do is to have shade, is to keep the radiation out. You know, awnings on windows, overhangs. Designers use. We design overhangs on additions so that in the summertime they sort of block the sun mm-hmm. from coming in the windows, and in the winter the sun is lower in the sky, and so you can take advantage of the solar gain.
And can that be as simple as good drapery that you close before the heat of the day too?
Well, that helps, but it's not as ideal. That's also a good question because the closer you are to the source of the radiation, the better. The more effective it is. For example, a cloud over the sun is more effective than a tree, which is more effective than an awning, which is more effective than a shade. But they all tend to help with that. Mm-hmm. You're hot, put a hat on. That helps block some mm-hmm. heat through a variety of things, but part of it is solar gain. So
is venting venting is effective for a particular kind of that heat gain?
Well, in the summertime, venting is a wonderful way to remove heat from the house. It helps cool the house down. It helps move moisture away from the house and takes the pressure off of your air conditioning unit if you're conditioning your space mm-hmm. with air conditioning. And that's a great way to cool it. It's just almost the opposite in the winter. In the winter, what you want to do is keep it cool, keep the roof cool, so it, you don't have ice and snow melt. But let's not say the S word too soon.
Well, John, what about insulation then? We talked a little bit about ventilation. I think we more often think of it as a way to keep cold out in the winter. But what's it doing for us in the summer?
In the summer, basically, what you're doing is you're producing resistance to the conduction of the heat down into the house. So it's the same thing you're really doing in the winter, except you're flipping it upside down. Mm-hmm. We're trying to keep the heat in the attic. And some of the things we have to think about are things like thermal bridging, because we may have a lot of insulation, but yet the framing of the house is still transferring the heat down. Mm-hmm. So when we design systems now, we're designing systems in a very different way, and we're trying to get rid of what's called thermal bridging. What has changed in my lifetime in insulation is really pretty amazing. We've gone from basically, if you had R12 or R19, you know, back in the 1970s, you were okay.
And that's how effective
a resistance factor. But nowadays, we don't design anything that doesn't have R50 in it, and we want to make sure that we conquer the thermal bridging. And this is done both in the walls and in the attics. And we have a lot of studies going on now about the use of foams of different sorts that are applied both inside and outside the house, sometimes both, so that basically we're taking the framing and we're putting it in a sandwich. Hmm. So we have that continuous thermal resistance against the conduction of heat either from the inside out in the winter or outside in the summer.
And so the thermal bridging is the goal to interrupt that so that there isn't that kind of transfer? Is that the idea?
That is correct. Okay. When we take a thermal image of a house in the winter, we can show you where every stud is in your wall if you have a typical house, because there will be 14.5 inches of relatively warm area where there's insulation. Then there's going to be a colder area where the wood is, because the wood has less thermal resistance. Wood has a thermal resistance of roughly R.133 per inch. So if you think about a stud wall, plain old stud wall, maybe it has R11 in the cavities, but then when we have just a 3.5 inch, we only have R4. So we go R11 for a wide area, R4, R11, R4. Now, if we end up putting an R12 or R9 insulation over the exterior, or 6 on the in and the out, we reduce that differential between the well-insulated cavity and the thermal bridging by a great deal, and we certainly lower greatly the amount of heat that is conductively moved through.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like insulation is doing a big job.
It is. One of the things that we try to do when we're doing additions and remodeling now is we come up with ways to reduce the number of studs in the wall. Mm. And you can do that with there's a variety of techniques. Sometimes you can use steel for instead of what's called a jack stud or a shoulder stud, the material that holds up a beam, for example. And then that gives you a little more wall space. And if you do this over the course of a house, you might be adding, 5 lineal feet of well-insulated space to a house. So these techniques, along with what John's talking about with regard to sandwiching, really helps a lot. So you want to increase your thermal mass in the wall. It's like my belly keeps me warm because it's bigger than John's.
So given what you guys just said, can we have too much insulation? Is there such a thing as too much?
There really is no such thing as too much insulation. What we have to control when we have insulation, this is really true in old houses, and most of our listeners aren't building new houses right now. If they were, we could design them a great house.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're in an old house. And one of the things that we find when we add insulation to old houses, we often add significant problems to them. One of the things that happens is in a really old house, my house when it was originally built had nothing in the walls except for in the mid wall it had a coat of plaster, which was to break break the 6-inch airspace into two places so it was more dead air. That's all it had for insulation. If you add insulation to that house, what happens is the dew point moves. So where is the cold spot where the humidity that's coming through this old house that doesn't have a vapor barrier, where is it going to condense? Most often, it's going to condense on the inside of the exterior sheathing. Now, most of our old houses in Wisconsin, if you're in a house here from, you know, late 1870s, 1880 into, what, 1930s, Ken, you're looking at balloon framing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there's no
true.
Real big headers. What we're relying upon is the board sheathing to keep this house stable. How's the sheathing attached? Steel nails. What happens when steel nails get wet winter after winter after winter? All of a sudden we have shearing and we have houses really moving. So we have to be very careful when we are re-insulating old houses. The other thing that we find in old houses is we can put in a heck of a lot of insulation and they're still hard to heat and cool. Mm. And that is because they have tremendous air leaks. Mm. And the number of calories that can be removed on an air leak compared to conduction is pretty radical. So we are really taking a lot of these old houses. We're coming into the attics. We're vacuuming out all of that old stuff, along with the mouse droppings and the other interesting things.
Know what you'll find, right?
Oh, yes. It's amazing what we found in attics. We could do a whole program on that. But we are actually putting down a urethane air seal, which also acts as a vapor barrier. We can put that down in maybe 2 inches, and then we can use an inexpensive ground-up fire-treated old newspaper cellulose to achieve good insulation. But we've stopped the air movement through it, we've stopped the moisture movement through it, and we have a system that is not going to break down due to moisture transfer.
We are talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger today, starting off talking about insulation, ventilation, and keeping your home comfortable in the summer. We will move on to other home improvement and repair topics, and you can join in. 1-800-642-1234 is the number. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or photo on our Facebook page. And sorry, Ken, you were going to add something there.
Oh, I was just going to say that when you ask about too much insulation, the other, what John's saying is all very, very important, and you can create a lot of problems, but there's also a diminishing return, and it depends on the economics of your situation. You can spend money on insulation that might not give you the return after you get to a certain point. So those are things that you can calculate out. How much money will you be saving? Sometimes it's more important to do a better job of insulating, and you know, you're not putting as much heat into the environment. You're not wasting energy that way.
So maybe if you have really poor insulation, it's a no-brainer to go the insulation route. But if you have quite good insulation, maybe the money is spent better somewhere else. What about doors and windows?
This is all part of the house package. So when you have an energy audit done by a certified energy auditor through what are some of the organizations now that focus on energy comes to mind? And we try to do that on every home before we start a remodel. And we look at all of these things. We look at the insulation in the walls, ceiling, attic, the basement. We look at ventilation for the house, how the home itself is breathing. We look for ventilation in bathrooms and kitchens. Mm-hmm. We look for heat loss, the way the heat plant is working. And all of these things are taken into consideration when we put together a design for improvement to a house. We have one that's exactly like my house. It's an old Dutch colonial from 1920s, built the same year. We vacuumed out all the insulation in the wall. They had the old-fashioned, the urethane insulation in the wall that turned to, was, you know, outgas poisonous gas for 15 years and then became ineffective as an insulator. So it was the worst of all worlds. We insulated the attic. We did dense pack foam in the walls. We put insulation on the outside of the walls down to the foundation, down below the below grade. And their house is pennies to heat in the winter and even less to cool in the summer. And so I was looking at their heat bill, feeling very jealous.
Well, earlier, Ken, you mentioned that we put a hat on to keep the sun off of us. But what we also choose clothes in the summer to wear that are lighter colors because we know that reflecting the sun yeah. will also keep us cooler. Is there a similar effect with houses?
Absolutely. You know, we always recommend that if you're looking at roof color to go with a slightly lighter color. It's going to reflect some of the heat out in the summer. It's going to keep the roof a little cooler. It's going to give the roof a little more longevity because it's not as warm. A hotter roof will, you know, could deteriorate, you know, 10% less life, you know, than it would normally, and what if would if it kept at a cooler temperature, even a few degrees. So siding, same thing. You know, if you're trying to reduce the amount of solar gain, amount of heat that's being sucked into the building in the summertime, lighter colors are always better. It's like wearing a light shirt. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you wear a black shirt and go out in the sun, what happens? You know,
you're right.
So, but it's just the opposite in the winter. You know, you're in the winter. You're trying to make sure you have more thermal protection, thicker insulation, moisture protection, and keep the heat in the house. It's a little bit of a different problem in the summer. Wouldn't you say, Jen?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And is there a way to measure how effective the reflection is on our home?
Yes. That's not my field of expertise, but I'm sure that John's got a few ideas.
There are measurements. It's a little bit on the complicated side. There are some rule of thumb to figure out. Basically, we're talking about albedo effect. I mean, from alba white. We find white surfaces reflect much better, and we can get a reflection index on a lot of materials that have been tested. And different materials, even the same color, will test out differently. And I think as we are going to be more and more planning lighter exteriors because of, well, you said summer was cool here in Wisconsin, but actually.
I said this summer.
This summer, yes, no. But in the world, this was the warmest June ever.
Right.
And so it is going to come back to us. So managing color and reflectivity is going to be something of the future. You know, for years we've been using the EPDM roofs, the rubber roofs, and of course they're black and they absorb a lot of heat. Now we have thermoplastics.
We have white EPDMs now too.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we are developing a lot of products to be able to reflect some of this heat back into the atmosphere rather than soak it into our buildings.
I think part of it is going to be a shift of what we find aesthetically pleasing, too, because we're not used to seeing, at least I'm not, seeing really light colored roofs.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying you have to have a white roof, but with, you know, if you're looking at a light shade of brown and a dark shade of brown as an example, go with a little lighter shade. You're going to save a little bit of energy. If you like a white roof, there's nothing wrong with it. And if you're putting it on a flat roof, you're not going to see it anyway. So might as well do something that's going to have benefit.
We are talking with Ken Adams and John Freigberger today about home improvement and repair. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in this week for Larry Mueller. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. But right now, we're talking about home improvement and repair with John Freigberger and Ken Adams. And let's go to the phones. And Scott in Madison is up first. Hi, Scott.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question on optimal AC function. And I've heard two conflicting theories that both kind of make sense. So the first would be closing vents in the basement and unused rooms to push the air towards the more desired places. But opposite of that, I've heard, too, that closing the vents increases the static pressure within your duct system, and it reduces the overall pushing power of your air, and that you should leave all vents open.
All right. Who's going to take a first crack at that?
Well, I'm going to go with the all vents open, because one of the problems that we can have if we reduce the airflow across the cooling coil, especially if we have high humidity, is icing of the coil. And once we get ice on the coil, we start really reducing its effectiveness. This can also lead to the growth of mold. What's really important, Scott, is that you are able to pick up warm air off the ceilings. Many older houses built before, say, 72 or so, when air conditioning became popular, simply don't have high returns. In many old houses that are two-story, the cold air return was the stairway, and there's no returns upstairs at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we spend a lot of time in houses trying to figure out how we are going to basically suck the hot air off the second floor ceiling or the first floor ceiling if it's a ranch house, so we can get that warmer air back to the air conditioner. Now, the warmer the air is that hits the air conditioner, the more efficiently it's going to operate as well. That is, for the same amount of electricity you're going to transfer, more BTUs. So you're going to want to check your house, Scott, and make sure that you've got a good balance between your return and have high returns. And, of course, if you have high returns, you have to be able to shut off the low returns in the summer. But those are usually paired. One's high on the wall, one's low on the wall, and you have a louver that you simply close. So Madison has a lot of good HVAC contractors, so almost any of them can probably take a look at your house for you and find ways of improving the airflow to increase the efficiency.
All right. Thanks for that call, Scott. Let's go next to Jim in Tomahawk. Hi, Jim.
Hi there.
Hi.
I promised that I'd pull off the road, shut off the truck, so I'm now dead. Thanks for the opportunity to ask a question. I'm building a new house, ranch home, and I'm doing a double wall construction. The exterior wall is a 2x6 frame, and I sprayed 3 inches of closed cell urethane on that exterior wall, and I capped all of the exposed 2x6s. And the top plate to the ceiling and the bottom plate to the floor. So, and then I came in 5.5 inches and put a 2x4 stud wall up. And I anticipate putting 6.25 inch bat, which is R19, in that void. And what I'm wondering about is if I need a vapor barrier on that interior or if the exterior sprayed foam is sufficient for a moisture barrier.
John?
Well, code-wise, you're going to need an interior vapor barrier because what you have right now is an exterior vapor barrier. So if you did have high vapor load in the house, you could end up with the sprayed urethane because you said, Jim, that's on the outside against the sheathing, right?
On the interior of the house, but it's filling the 2x6 spaces. It's not on the exterior of the home. No, it's inside the house.
Okay, but it's on the cold side of the insulation, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So basically, you've got a vapor barrier. You're building a great house for Florida, so you are going to need an interior vapor barrier as well, and you're going to have to be very careful. You really want an air and vapor barrier because, frankly, vapor barriers are more or less worthless. They have so many holes in them, they're so poorly sealed that we get air movement.
It's all in the construction technique.
That's
right. A lot of times people use too thin a material, they cut it, they have a knife cuts in it, and it doesn't do any good, and then they put holes in it.
And the electrician doesn't seal things well enough. So you're going to want to make sure that you air seal very well so that we have no air movement into this wall and we have no vapor migration either.
So having said that, you're looking at R34 with an air gap in between of 3 inches, it sounds like. Does that sound correct, or are you filling that cavity?
Well, I'll be filling that cavity for the most part.
Okay.
There might be a little bit of a spot of space, but it's pretty much filling.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could consider putting some sensors in the wall to see if you ever reach the dew point. I'm sure you can get them fairly easily and monitor them in different times of the year. If you're not reaching the dew point, you're not going to get moisture in the wall and you're okay. But that still precludes getting a vapor barrier on the inside at this point.
Hmm. If for a follow up, so I will do the six. I've got 6 mil plastic for a vapor barrier because I just want an affirmation, but. What I anticipate doing is using adhesive to glue it and then seal it with caulk.
That would work.
Kind of, right,
tape,
correct.
You know, yeah, make sure if you do any taping, tape it each surface to the adjoining piece of material and make sure there's nothing that can leak through and you'll be good to go.
All right. Good luck with that, Jim. And we had an email from Julie. She says, I live in a ranch house built in the later 1950s, and the walls are concrete all the way up and covered with some siding. It is really cold in winter and warm in summer. We insulated the attic last year, and it exceeds what is recommended. What can we do to make it warmer in the winter? It costs over $250 a month just to keep the heat on 68 when we're at home.
Yikes.
So we keep it at a constant 64.
Yeah, concrete has concrete block has very little thermal resistance. If it's a 12-inch block, it's R1.28, and if it's an 8-inch block, it's R1.1. So
wow.
It's like going outside in shirt sleeves in the winter.
Yeah, it's really bad. Generally, when we have these houses, we find that we need to cover them with something, and either exterior or interior or both.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the exterior insulation finish systems are good for houses like this because we can add several inches of foam to the exterior. Sometimes the exterior detailing doesn't work with that, and then we can use the same sort of thing on the interior of the house. But basically, you're going to have to add thermal resistance through the use of plastic foams to be able to make this house thermally resistant.
Well, the other problem that Julie may have is I've seen a lot of these homes that were built at that time frame out of cement block have steel windows. And so the frames of the windows are aluminum windows, and the frames just, you know, allow so much heat loss. Mm-hmm. It's you could really insulate the heck out of the home and you still have an issue. So then you'll have to look at your windows and what can you do there. So there's a lot of issues that come into play.
We were talking about thermal bridging earlier with the concrete walls. Is that basically the bridging is happening every square inch of that house?
Yep, basically,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's being transferred just constantly.
We know how cold our windows are in our well-insulated house in the winter. Now, here you have walls that have less thermal resistance than a pane of glass and a storm window in your house.
Mm-hmm.
So think if your entire house was made of glass with a leaky storm window. That is what
wow.
Julie is dealing with.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, with when you consider that, $250 a month isn't that bad.
Maybe really, it's only a 400-square-foot house. Who knows? Well, good luck with that, Julie. Sounds like wrapping it inside and out is the way to go. Let's go back to the phones, and Kathy in Green Bay is up next. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have a question. I have a cooler that is attached to a trailer hitch on a little cargo trailer. And I bought a thermal blanket, one of those that you just supposed to keep you warm in an emergency or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Could I use that thermal blanket and make a cover to insulate that cooler because it's outside all the time at campgrounds?
And why do you want to insulate the cooler?
To keep it cooler and, you know, in the hot summer days and stuff. I got ice and everything in there, but if I make a cover to cover that cooler out of this blanket.
Yeah, people do that. You see that, you know, people have water bottles and they'll cover them with this reflective material, and that tends to keep them cooler a little bit longer. I'm sure it'll be fine. And, you know, that's an inexpensive piece of fabric.
Right.
I imagine you're pretty good with a sewing machine. Is that
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, try it. Give it a shot, and it should help.
And so basically what Kathy wants to do with her cooler is what you're recommending we do with our houses, try
That's
to
right.
reflect off.
Exactly.
The
put
heat.
A hat on in the sun.
Put a hat on that house. Thanks for that call, Kathy. Let's go now to Tom in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a high efficiency Lennox furnace in my house. The furnace motor was not a high efficiency that ran the fan, and I had a high efficiency motor put in to run that fan, and the installer of the motor suggested that I just leave that fan run all the time, and I was just wondering your thoughts on that as far as whether that's a good idea or if it doesn't make any difference one way or another.
Well, I know a fair amount of people who leave their fans on regularly, especially in the summertime. The fan might be going, the windows could be open, and they're just basically using it to circulate the air.
Yep, that's what we do.
To help with the convection. You know, basically it shouldn't hurt anything. Fans are incredibly efficient, and you get many, many years of good service out of it, and if the technician believes that it can handle it, I say go for it.
All right. John?
I think that's fine. The new variable speed fans are really wonderful, mm-hmm. and the nice thing about running these variable speed fans continuously is you don't have the power surges as you start things up. Mm. And usually what seems to kill motors over the long period of operation is the surges for startup.
Okay. Well,
that's a good point.
So there you go, Tom. Thanks for calling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a home improvement or a repair project that you're tackling this summer? John and Ken would love to hear about it and to offer any advice that you might need. And is your home cool in the summer? Have you done any improvements to make it that way, or did you just get lucky? We'd like to hear about that as well. Again, 1-800-642-1234. Todd and Delavan emailed, "We have an 8.5-year-old house. The last couple of years, I've noticed staining on the north side of our roof. I've since noticed this on other homes, both new and old. It's always there, whether it's dry or wet weather. What is this, and should I be concerned?" John?
Well, it's non-green plant growth, and this most likely is an area that's fairly shaded or a neighborhood that where the microclimate is sort of humid, so things grow on the roof. It doesn't cause any real damage. Maybe on a 30-year roof, it's going to last 29 instead of 30 years. If you're replacing a roof and you live in that sort of neighborhood, there are shingles that are available, I believe, from GAF and others that have in them little zinc crystals. Hmm. Now, you may have seen some of these old farmhouses in the country that have these metal ridges across the roof, and you'll notice streaks on them where it's very clean. Because what's happening there is the zinc is coming off, and it's working sort of as a biocide. So we actually have shingles for wet climates where it will discourage the non-green and green plant growth. And they're not much more expensive. They cost exactly the same to put on.
So I'm guessing, actually, I hadn't really cued into it at first, but when you said that, John, he said it's on the north side of the house, and that's the part of the house that gets the least amount of sun, which probably makes it easier for things like that to grow.
That is correct. And you'll even see houses with a lot of trees around them where you'll find it on multiple pitches of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Air movement, sun. This is one of the places where sun does help us. It does help get these shingles dry so that we don't grow things on our roofs.
Let's go back to the phones and Larry in Eau Claire. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is on adding foam insulation to the exterior walls. I have a house, 3-bedroom ranch built in the 70s, 4-inch walls, bad insulation. And it costs me between $600 and $700 on a typical winter to heat the house. Would it be cost-effective to put foam insulation in those exterior walls?
Well, another good question. Larry, what kind of siding do you have on the house?
I just added fiber cement.
Okay.
And I made it dark, and it really absorbs the heat in the winter from the sun.
I'll bet you. I bet it does.
Really made a difference.
Well, the reason I ask that is because to put exterior insulation on, that means you have to take your siding off. And fiber cement, if you take that siding off, you're going to end up having to replace it with new fiber cement. And all of a sudden, it gets to the point where the expense may not be worth it. If you're only spending $600 a season to heat the house, you know, how much is it going to cost you to re-side that house? And how long is the payback for that?
So is that $600 a winter or a month?
Winter.
Okay.
Yeah.
This last winter cost me a little over $900.
But it was a pretty cold winter.
But I thought maybe they could drill holes and then blow it in through the holes.
You say the cavity has, the wall cavity has bad insulation in there? Is that correct?
Yes.
And so your siding is applied to the outside of that?
Yes.
So there's no space to blow in behind it?
Okay.
So you see what I mean?
Possible. Then.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you could take
much.
You could take the siding off, put it on, put new siding on. Is it worth it? It may be. You know, I don't know how deep your pockets are, but if it's important to you that that you want as green a house as possible, then maybe it is.
Mm-hmm. Larry, consider having an energy audit done this next winter with some thermal imaging. And, you know, maybe we're going to find that with $600 worth of work in the attic and some air sealing that you're going to get your heating bill so low that it just doesn't pay to do anything else. But spend the money on an energy audit. So you want a blower door test to check infiltration, exfiltration, as well as some thermal imaging. And that'll give you some science. And then with that, you can do some pricing, and you can come up with a cost-benefit analysis that makes sense for you.
Thanks for that call, Larry. You're listening to The Larry Miller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Miller, talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger about home improvement and repair. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Talking about home improvement and repair with Ken Adams and John Freiberger, and taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Miller Show. And Tim did just that. He posted on the Facebook page, "My girlfriend and I close on a house next week, and it needs a lot of work. We need to rescue the wood floors, replace, trim, and paint everything. I want to ask your guests, in what order should we tackle these projects? We do not have to move in right away," so he's looking for minimal recleaning.
Oh, that's a very good point. Yeah. Well, when we do a project like that, when we're first getting ready to move into a house, we start with the ugliest stuff first, and it's usually something to do with a substrate. So anything you, any demolition that you have to do, if you have to take off a wall surface or repair the tile in the bathroom around the tub, that sort of, or replace a tub, do that stuff first, and you do the ugly stuff first, and you work your way out. After you get that done, you can do drywall repair. Maybe you're ready to paint at that point, and then do your hardwood floors last, because the last thing in the world you want to do is have this gorgeous hardwood floor that you just finished and you drop a hammer on it, mm-hmm. and the
or
rest of your
something
or drag something across it, and for the rest of your life living there you go, what a knucklehead. so start from the ugly to the pretty, and the top down is usually a pretty good bet.
John, anything to add on that?
Well, when I talk to new homeowners and do home inspections, we suggest to people they actually put together a 5-year plan.
Yeah.
And we don't want to go ahead and repair the drywall, and then we talked about earlier about we need to add high returns. Well, then we're cutting the high returns later. So let's check the mechanical systems. Do we have electrical issues? Do we have plumbing issues? Do we have HVAC issues? Let's make sure we have those things done first. Now, hopefully, Tim had a good, competent home inspector, and that home inspector gave them sort of a to-do list. But they really need to think about what they're going to do and then do them in the right order.
Mm. So you don't want to fix something that's going to have to be redone because of some other project a year or two down the road.
That's right. You may be thinking about in a few years you're going to put insulation in the attic. Well, instead of just painting the ceilings, let's paint the ceilings with a vapor barrier resistant paint. Mm-hmm. It's going to cost maybe $10 more for the entire house to do it correctly. But let's make a list of everything we're going to do in 5 years, and then let's rank those.
Yeah, and typically when you remodel, there's a sequence of events, and when you remodel on your own, you follow that same sequence.
All right. Good question. Let's go back to the phones and Jake in Salem, Oregon. Hi, Jake.
Hi. Yeah. So first thing I want to talk about is we're well acquainted with moss and mold on roofs in Oregon. And there's a previous caller that asked about moss on the roof. And in Oregon, what we do is just below the ridge cap, there's zinc strips that are about 2 inches wide by 100 feet long, and you just flip those under the ridge cap. Mm-hmm. And as it rains, the zinc actually leaches over the roof and kills all the moss.
Hmm.
But my question actually pertains to roofs as well. We are building a house in the foreseeable future, and we're using a SIP-style roof, which is structurally insulated panels.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be sheathing that with metal roofing. And I was wondering if your experts there could comment on the recommended buildup for the roof. I've seen installing it just on normal 30-pound felt and also using a rain screen type technique underneath it, or cedar breather. And if they could comment on that, that'd
sure.
be great.
All right.
Can you tell me a little bit what you mean by cedar breather?
It's an engineered mesh.
Like you'd use under a cedar shingle
roof?
Yeah,
and I guess the goal there is just to give the roof deck just a little bit of something to breathe in case you do have water underneath.
Yeah, I'm not real fond of the cedar breather. It's better than nothing. But a 1-inch airspace is what we really like to see, a rain screen system on the wall and a vented roof system. There should be some panels that are available that have the 1-inch vent built into them. I know that we have them available here in Wisconsin because the Cornell Company makes them here in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that somebody would have them out there. So you should be able to actually get the structural panels out there with the airspace.
If that doesn't work, you could... I think most steel roof manufacturers recommend a felt type material that goes on the panel below it. That could be laid out, and then you have your furring. However, the furring is makes sense with your particular style roof, and okay. Then that goes on.
And with the the pre-manufactured furring, do they just sort of put a secondary sheet of OSB on there, or how does that work?
Yes, they use little square blocks, like 2-inch by 2-inch blocks that are bonded to the foam, and then they have the OSB over that.
And what's OSB?
Oriented strand board. Yeah,
the kind of plywood.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Thanks for that call, Jake. Let's go back to the phones and Karen in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, I have elderly parents who do not follow energy issues, and they went ahead and put a new roof on their house, and they chose black shingle. Now, their house is too hot to begin with, and you can imagine how hot it is now. I've heard that in Germany and other countries where they're keen on this sort of thing, they either use light-colored shingles or they have a way of painting them, painting a roof light-colored or white. Is that possible on new shingles?
I would recommend against any kind of a paint over the top of an asphalt shingle. I don't know of any that has any longevity at all. Is the attic insulated?
I don't think so, and it's not vented either. I mean, they really need to
okay.
do both.
Yeah, you've got... This is an example similar to the gentleman that has a bunch of work to do, and they did it out of sequence. But it's there's this hope you might be able to still retrofit ventilation, and you might still be able to get it insulated if you've got access to the attic.
Yes.
That's good. That's good. How much space is up there?
It's sort of crawl space. It's not standing room. It's
okay. John recommended earlier to have an energy audit done. This is a great thing for you to have with your parents. I'm sure that as they're getting older, they want to do less work around the house. And if they have a very good scientific piece of knowledge about what is wrong with their house, they could come to a determination about what needs to be done to repair those deficiencies. So start there. Somebody that's got a focus on energy background that can do, if you remember, did you hear what John was saying earlier about a blower door test and about,
yeah.
So you'll want to do those kinds of things.
You've got a great resource up there, Karen, in the University of Minnesota Cold Climate Housing
Lab. Yes.
So they have all kinds of things that you can download. I'm always going there for things. The other thing, and we may already have this on Larry's website, is to go to a website called CoreVent.com. They make venting materials for retrofitting houses where you get more air movement through the vents than you do with many of the typical things you can get at the lumberyard. But if you just Google CoreVent, it's a very useful website. Good quality.
How's that spelled, Jen?
CoreVent.com.
And we will have Carl put that up. He's on it right now.
It's very helpful. It will give you some explanation. They have changed the website.
We were just saying
they changed the website, and it isn't as easy to use as it used to be. But they do have very good products that are tried and true. They test everything down at only 5 pascals of pressure, which is not much. And they get really good airflow. So if you have a house with not much pitch on the roof, not much headroom, CoreVent may be the way to go.
All right. Thanks for that call, Karen. Jackie on Facebook said, I want to put a metal roof on a small, simple rental duplex. Is this going to be significantly more expensive to use metal, even the thinner metal with 40-year warranty? What type of underlayment should be used?
Good question. Cost as a matter of time. Sometimes the initial cost could be higher, but over time it becomes less expensive. So the initial cost will almost certainly be higher. Mm-hmm. If you're thinking that you've got a 40, 50, or a lifetime warrantied roof, how valuable is that? I mean, if you plan on holding on to this for more than, say, 30 or 40 years, then it's really worth you know, it could very well be worth the money for you. There's some different kinds of roofs, different kinds of metal roofs you probably know about. There's the old-fashioned, you've seen, it looks like a long sheet with a little ridge. There's shingles now, metal shingles that you can put on. Some advantage to the shingles is that they will contour over a roof that's got little bellies and imperfections in it, whereas the long sheet roof will oil can and maybe not sit properly. So your roofer should be able to help you if you have a roofer that has a lot of experience with metal roofs, they can help direct you to the correct roof for your application.
And Jackie also asked what type of underlayment should be used, felt, rubber?
Well, there again, they have, each manufacturer has a recommendation, and there's a synthetic felt material that people, I think, are basically putting on most roofs. Some of these roofs you can put right over the top of shingles. I don't like to do that, and I'm a little bit of a purist. I'd like to take the old shingles off, inspect the roof sheathing, repair anything that needs to be done, and then properly prepare the underlayment and go from there.
And I have to say, we on the addition that we put on our house, we have a metal roof, and it has the raised ridges. And so because we wanted to put solar panels on.
They call it standing seam.
Standing seam. And it was very nice because putting solar panels on, we didn't have to compromise the roof by drilling through it. We could just clamp the solar panels on it.
No, so. That's an advantage to that, yeah.
Because I think
and
the
it was
roof,
an addition, wasn't it?
It was an addition, so we were starting fresh, so we didn't have to worry about
a roof with a belly.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones and Michelle in Racine. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a house that was built in 1972 about, and it has asphalt slate siding on it, and everyone else in our neighborhood has gotten vinyl siding. And when I asked my brothers, you know, is that a good idea? Would it be warmer in the winter if we got the vinyl siding? They said, no, the slate is a better insulator and you should just keep it on. You shouldn't mess with it. And then when I ask other people, they say, oh, no, you can put the vinyl siding right over it. And I'm thinking if you nail through it, that breaks up the slate tiles, and then that would be worse.
I'm wondering what
you think. John? Well, we have got several interesting things going on here. If these tiles contain asbestos, and if they're made before 78, they may well, you cannot penetrate them. You would have to completely remove them. Because they have asbestos in them, there's not much insulation value there. But then again, there isn't much insulation value in vinyl siding. So you're talking about such minuscule differences between the two. The nice thing about that product is that it's a non-friable form of asbestos. As long as you keep it painted, it lasts forever. It's fireproof. My first house had it on, and I painted it a really nice Amish blue, and I thought it was great.
It holds paint very well if it is that product, yeah.
Yeah, so I would probably invest in things other than replacing the siding.
Okay, I was also thinking, should I get insulation blown into the walls? But then I know you were talking about it. It depends on how the wall is constructed. So would that be an option?
The problem with it is you would have to find somebody who can take some of these asbestos pieces off and put them back on without breaking them. Now, I believe, haven't we found that you can actually get some aftermarket replacements for them?
Right. They're asbestos-free, and their texture looks a little bit different, but you can still do that. But there's another alternative, too. If you don't mind having your house in upheaval for a while, you could do it from the inside. And we're actually doing it right now in a house that people just bought, and they want to move in, and they've got a beautiful exterior siding, and we don't want to drill through it or remove it. So we're going from the inside walls. We're drilling through the plaster. We're blowing dense pack cellulose in from that, from the inside, and then we're going to fill those holes and replaster that. So that's another possibility. Back again to an energy audit, you know, these things really have value, so you may want to consider something like that.
1972 house may be quite leaky and may have an attic that is poorly insulated. Mm-hmm. So again, you always want to pick the low-hanging fruit, which in this case is the thing that reduces your BTU loss the most for the fewest dollars out there.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. Both Ken and I are really cheap guys.
Well, and speaking of being really cheap guys, how much does an energy audit cost? Say that wherever someone is living, there are no, say, rebates or help with that through the city or Focus on Energy.
Yeah, there's fewer and fewer kickbacks and rebates and so forth out there now, but you can expect to pay anywhere from about $375 to about $600, depending on who you choose and what the schedule is. Last one we did was $400.
Okay. And a lot of those things that you find out from that are, like you said, the low-hanging fruit. You might be able to make some pretty inexpensive adjustments that will save you that money or earn you that money back.
I mean, you could find a bath vent that the damper is stuck open and you're pouring pouring hot air out in the wintertime. And that's a very cheap fix. You know, stuff like that can be very evident very quickly.
All right. Thanks for that call, Michelle. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller this week. Ken Adams is the owner of Adams Design Construction in Madison, and John Freiberger is a Wisconsin registered home inspector who specializes in the evaluation of older structures. He is the founder of Freiberger and Associates in Fitchburg, Wisconsin. And I wanted to let you know that Carl did put the website up for Core Event, so people can find that for all that great information about ventilation. That's up on the Facebook page, which is The Larry Mueller Show. John and Ken are with us right up until 12:30 today, so I hope you'll stay tuned. We're going to take a look at the news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned to the Ideas Network. Like many things in life, it can be a little too easy to not pay attention to our home's upkeep until something goes wrong. But inevitably, something needs to be fixed, and we need advice we can rely on. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Glad you could join us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're lucky to have two pros that know a lot and have a good time sharing their experiences as well. Ken Adams is the owner of Adams Design Construction in Madison. Great to have you back, Ken.
It's good to be here.
It is always fun, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And John Freiberger is a Wisconsin registered home inspector who specializes in the evaluation of older structures. He's the founder of Freiberger and Associates in Fitchburg. Always a pleasure, John.
Always a pleasure indeed.
Well, let's go back to the phones because Dave in Monona has been patiently waiting. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a bonus room above my garage that was finished with kind of a rough OSB. It's got some seams visible. My teenage son wants to make it into a man cave, and we thought about working on it together. And I just wondered if you had any recommendations how to finish the OSB walls with minimal investment. I don't really want a drywall over it. And I was considering caulking the seams and painting over it, but I didn't know if you guys had any better recommendations.
Did you correct him that it's really more of a boy cave if he's a teenager?
Well, you won't want to hear
turn
that.
Him into a man with this project.
There you go. Perfect answer, Dave.
One of the things that actually I did this in my garage and it turned out just great is I used amber shellac, and it just brought out this deep orangey red color in the OSB. I thought it looked great, but you can only put it. It doesn't adhere well to the smooth side. There's a wax side, so hopefully they put the rough side out.
And it is primed already. So
oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah, so I don't think I have that option.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. Paint would probably, pick a nice paint. But caulking the seams wouldn't hurt, especially across the rafters or studs. Is it insulated? Will it be used will it be conditioned?
Yes, it is insulated, and it's got a heating and air conditioning unit separate from the house. So.
Well, this kid's got it made.
Yeah, exactly. So paintable caulk, and is there a specific type of paint you'd use, or not really?
I'd use some, like a low, we use a lot of low VOC paints.
What's VOC?
Well, thank you.
Volatile organic compounds.
Right. Thanks. So it's basically stuff you don't want to breathe.
Right.
Most water-based paints will once they are cured, they're inert, they're safe, so... just to pick a nice color that you like and try it out. It's a rough surface, a little bit of a rough surface, so You'll know that it's always going to be a little bit of a rough surface, but hey, it's a man cave.
That just adds to the appeal, right? Hey, Dave, will you take a picture of your son working on the man cave and send it to us?
Yes, exactly. Flexing his biceps, I'm sure.
That would be great. Send that to talk@wpr.org, and we'll put that up on the Facebook page. We'll want to keep him honest and track his progress on this.
That's right.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. We had a couple related questions, and it's something I think it's important to say. Gail on Facebook asked, should a metal roof be grounded? And Neil from Sussex said, my neighbor's home this week was hit by lightning, which caused a fire that resulted in an almost complete loss of their home. Should people have lightning rods on their homes? And if so, how much does it cost to have them installed? John?
Yes, they should have. I have them on my house and on my barn. We've had a lot of lightning strikes in the area. Unfortunately, copper is really expensive. I can't remember how much I paid for the last coil of copper, but I think it was something like $400.
Well, it's so expensive that there's a lot of copper theft.
There's
right?
a lot of copper, and it's a loosely woven copper so that it doesn't overheat as it transfers the electricity. There are various companies that sell the lightning rods. You can get the copper through any electrical supply house. You can do this yourself unless you're on a steep pitch roof and it's dangerous. There is some online information. There's New England Lightning Rod Company and others. So you really should ground all metal roofs. And if you're in a high lightning area, you know, if you're in a valley in the middle of a city, you probably don't get a lot of lightning strikes. I'm out on the prairie. And out
yeah,
on
you're
the prairie,
a prime candidate for
yeah,
that,
I'm yeah. I'm just a prime candidate. I have most of my large 300-year-old oak trees have lightning strike repairs on them. I mean, there were places where the bark has split open and then has healed. So I know I'm in a high lightning area. So it's certainly worth doing. But Ken, wouldn't you think anybody with a metal roof, even in town, it is so easy to ground them?
Yeah, it's not very hard at all, and it should be done.
And right. when we say ground it, what exactly mm-hmm. are we talking about?
Well,
what are we trying to
in very basic terms, it would be like taking and pounding a stake in a copper coated stake into the ground so that it goes below the frost line, and then connecting it to the roof with jumper cables. Now, that's the simple solution. It's a little more complicated.
So basically, than that, if there's a lightning strike and the electricity hits the roof, it gets conducted into the ground.
It's got a place to go.
It can't do any damage.
Right. The easiest path is through the copper conductor.
Right.
Rather than it's going to take more energy to go through the wood and the brick. And, of course, when it goes through them, it heats them up because of the resistance. And that's where we end up with the multiple fires in houses.
And so if it's not grounded, where does the electricity go from that
well,
roof?
Just like John
through,
says, it
through the whole electrical
through the house.
System.
Right. Through the electrical system. I just talked to some folks that had a lightning strike on their house, and it blew all of their electric circuits out. They had rainbow of sparkles coming out of their light fixtures, and it started three or four fires in their walls.
Wow.
So they were very fortunate not to lose their house.
Wow. So good advice. Thanks both to Gail and Neil for bringing up that issue. Let's go back to the phones and Carol in Green Bay. Hi, Carol.
Hello.
Hi.
We have a 13-year-old Energy Star Ranch house with 24-inch on center wood framing. And we had cellulose blown into the as insulation into our walls and our ceiling. And we have a closet, a walk-in closet, on the southwest corner of the house. And on the south wall of that, when it's really cold, moisture collects on the ceiling and on the very top couple inches of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And we have used a fan to try and keep air circulating in there. We have really kept our humidity low. And we wonder if maybe the insulation has shifted around in the attic.
There's a very good possibility that you have what we call a cold spot. When they insulated it, they missed a spot, or it settled. The insulation could have settled a little bit. They might not have put it in under the same amount of pressure. Moisture will always find its way to the coldest spot. That's why if you have a lot of humidity in your house in the wintertime, your windows condense because they typically are not as well insulated as the rest of the walls. A closet that's closed, doesn't have any air circulating around it, Maybe you've got an insulated jacket or something leaning up against it or very close to it. It's gonna be a cold place if there's a flaw in the insulation somewhere. It's hard to say how to fix it unless I were to be able to look at it. But a short answer would be, you could have someone shoot the area with an infrared camera and see if it's a cold spot. Now, you need a temperature variation between the inside and the outside, so you couldn't probably do it mm-hmm. today. But that will tell you if you've got a cold spot due to a lack of insulation, or maybe there's some moisture that found its way in, a break in the vapor barrier, something that is cooling that area.
John,
you want to add anything?
If the attic is completely inaccessible, since this is a closet, one could take out the ceiling and part of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes what we find on houses is that the average insulation is very good,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't put big enough energy heels on the trusses so that when we get to near the outside walls, instead of having R44, where all of a sudden we're down to R19 or R12.
Mm-hmm.
And those we end up retrofitting usually with foam.
Yeah.
Another possibility is simply to put a 2-inch layer of foam over the drywall ceiling and the outside wall and put drywall over that so that you've then added insulation on the inside. If you did that with a good quality isocyanate, you could probably add about between R15 and R16. That'd be very inexpensive. Just pop off the base trim, have that put in, make your closet a little bit smaller, but very inexpensive and non-invasive.
You know, you definitely want to know why it's happening mm-hmm. first, because if you've got some sort of a flaw that's, you know, you don't want to be hiding a problem that's going to rear its ugly head
right.
worse down the road. But that's good advice.
The other thing that happens, Carol mentioned this was the southwest corner of the house, and that mm-hmm. is where she's getting her prevailing wind load. And we will find on a well-vented house, if they did not do a real good job with insulation dams, and sometimes all they did is they shoved some batting in there, friction-fit batting,
yeah.
that the wind has shoved the batting out of the way and blown the insulation off of that area in the attic, and you'll find it to be bare.
Mm-hmm.
But as Ken said, with thermal image, you'll probably pick that up.
So a thermal imaging camera, you would use that on the inside or on the outside of the house?
Okay. Well, an energy auditor would be able to help you, or a good insulation contractor that has the knowledge and capability and equipment to do an imaging test on your home. And what that is they shine an infrared camera on the walls and ceiling, and they look for any inconsistency. They look for variations in temperature, and they should be able to see. They basically see into the wall. And so they'd be able to tell you if there's something in the wall, either moisture or a loss of insulation, settling of insulation, that should help give you some guidance. If this is right under the roof line too, you might be able to, once you find out what that is, you might be able to take some of the soffit off and do some of the work from the outside if it's up at the right at the top of the wall. But all of these things are all, you know, just speculative until you have a good look at it.
Right. We need a little science. And you may find that a local building inspector also can do this, because many of the home inspectors now have the ability to do thermal imaging.
All right. Thanks for that call, Carol. Let's go next to Shatek and Dolores. Hi, Dolores.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question. I'm quite confused, and I'm hoping they can help clear up some of my confusion, but I'm working at an old farmhouse that I want to resite, and I've received really different opinions about metal, vinyl, and smart side. Do they have any feedback that could help me in making a decision?
Well, we keep talking about science, don't we? Before you reside this house, because you're taking the old siding off, you have a wonderful opportunity to change the thermal characteristics of this house. You want to make sure you have a good wind wrap on it so that you're going to decrease the infiltration, exfiltration. You have the possibility of adding insulation by putting foam on the exterior. You have the possibility of putting on a rain screen system. And you can always go to the U.S. Forest Products Lab website for information about rain screen systems here in Madison. The type of siding, I don't think, makes a lot of difference. I think really that's an aesthetic thing. It's simply that it needs to be applied well. If you use something like SmartSide, the rain screen is really going to help that SmartSide perform better and last longer and make sure it's primed on all sides. With the vinyl and the metal sidings, it isn't going to make that much of a difference as far as the long-term performance. So some of this is aesthetics. What do you want this farmhouse to look like? Certainly using something like SmartSide, and you may want to take a look also at Hardy Plank as well, is you can get something that you can make it look quite a bit the way it did when it was first constructed. It's hard to do that in vinyl, although there are some very good vinyls out there, and the same with metal. So a lot of that's aesthetics, but plan this all out. Figure out what your entire project should entail before you proceed.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dolores.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right. And let's go next to Dave in Cumberland. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you. My question concerns a new home I built last winter. It's partially in the ground in the backside. It's one half in the ground. So I laid a 12-inch block foundation, and then I put I framed inside of that for the interior, you know, rooms. So against that block foundation, I put a half-inch styrofoam with a reflective barrier on it. So and then that was between the block wall and the 2x4 stud wall. Then I put 3-inch R11 insulation bats in that wall and ultimately sheetrock. Well, after about a month or so, I ended up seeing part of the wall was open and the other part was closed. There was moisture between the insulation and the vapor barrier styrofoam. And I got real concerned about that was something that was terrible. And I was kind of reassured that, okay, it's on a concrete slab. So I had all the concrete and all the sheetrock work and everything, and there was a lot of moisture introduced into the house and still present, and was told that it will dissipate. Is that something I should be concerned about, or will it dissipate?
Right. Well, I have a couple quick questions for you, and I'm sure John's going to really have a lot because this is one of his fields, one of his areas of expertise. But is this moisture on the inside of the vapor barrier in the interior of the house?
Yes.
Okay.
It's the vapor barrier, and then the fiberglass is against that vapor barrier.
Okay. So it's between the fiberglass and the vapor barrier seeing moisture?
Yes.
Okay. So it's being generated from your living in the house and
inside, from the inside. Well, now we weren't living there at that time. It was just all new construction, everything. See?
Right, right. And what's on the floor? Is the floor concrete or is it something?
The floor is concrete. It's a slab with heat in the floor.
Oh, interesting. Well, I'll turn this over to John. I just wanted to one of the things I just wanted to ask you about it was, is there exposure to the concrete? Because concrete will sometimes take years to get all of the moisture out of it, and it just, you know, if there's moisture, I've seen moisture come from the outside in on new homes, but I haven't from the inside out. So
John, ahead. What would you say?
Okay, I'm just going to re-ask Ken's question, so I want to make sure that I've got this correctly. So what we have on the exterior is we've got a concrete block, then we've got half inch of foil-faced insulation. Is that
yes.
correct? Okay, and then we've got 3.5 inches of fiberglass. Then we've got a plastic vapor barrier.
Not a plastic vapor barrier. I was told by inspection that you have a vapor barrier already there with the foil-faced business. Mm-hmm.
Right, we do, and we've got the vapor barrier in the wrong place. We've got the vapor barrier on the cold part of the wall, so that is going to become an issue.
Okay.
So we do need an interior vapor barrier there. And Ken is right. It takes a while for houses to dry down, usually at least a year, but it would seem that assembly doesn't meet Wisconsin code, and I would think that you're going to have to put either a liquid-applied vapor barrier where it's drywalled and make sure you've got everything airtight, and where it hasn't been drywalled, you're going to need to put some visqueen up, and that's going to have to be sealed very carefully the way Ken described to a previous caller. Because right now, you've only got about R3. You've got an 8-inch concrete block, which is R1.1, and then you've got about R3 of that foil. So you're going to keep that wall, considering that soil's probably in the mid-50s, you're going to have a cold area there where you have that impermeable foil, and you're going to get continuous condensation there. That is then going to feed into the wood framing you have, and you're going to end up with mold. So you're going to have to look at this and detail it really carefully.
Would I be advantaged to put styrofoam on the outside of the blocks? I mean, it's only about 2.5 feet out of the ground on the backside.
Well, I'm a little surprised you don't have styrofoam. You have styrofoam below grade, don't you?
Not on the backside, no.
Okay, I'm a little surprised. There's pretty strong code in the Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code about heated slabs and the amount of insulation that you need. And my memory, I don't have the code book with me, is that you were supposed to have 2 inches of foam on the exterior of that wall with a heated slab plus a full thermal break. So
the front side where the frost footings are, with the exposed side of the house, that's all done like that.
So they let you get away with this, huh?
Yeah. So what would you say Dave's next step would be?
I'd consult with somebody. Check with knowledgeable home inspectors in your area or an architect. Who designed the house for you, Dave?
I did myself.
Okay. I would probably, consult with, get some professional consultation, because it sounds like you have an assembly there that is going to cause long-term problems.
All right. Thanks for that call, Dave. And with just a couple minutes left, let's take a quick call from Joanne in Menominee Falls. Hi, Joanne.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a cabin up north in Florence County. It has electric heat. We keep it on time of rate use. And it, needless to say, it's under some trees. We've taken a few out. It has asphalt shingling on it right now. I am in negotiation for putting a steel roof on it.
Mm-hmm.
One side has a bad pitch, so they're going to be replacing the pitch. The problem I have, I know you talked about steel roofs, but the problem in that area is the fungus and the molds and all that stuff on the roof. Am I going to still have that problem with the steel roof?
Pretty likely. It's not going to be a problem for the roof, but you will still see a little bit of mold in the wet. If it doesn't dry out, it's a great place for mold and fungus to grow.
But it sounds, Ken, like you're saying that it would be more an aesthetic issue than that it would actually damage
right.
the metal roof.
Right. If you're careful, you could hose it down once in a while. You want to be careful not to get any water into your vents.
Mm-hmm.
It can be washed, and it'll last, you know, forever. Virtually.
Whereas on an asphalt roof, can mold and fungus eventually cause
some
degradation?
Well, it can, but we remember our caller from Salem, Oregon, who was noting that the zinc strips that you can add to the roofs, and I noted mm-hmm. earlier in the program that you can get shingles that have zinc in them as well. So you may want to, Joanne, take a look at asphalt products that are protected by zinc, or even some of the retrofit zinc strips that you can put in. So either of them may work.
All right. Thanks for that call, Joanne. And Ken and John, the time has flown by as always. It's amazing how that happens.
It is.
Ken
it Adams. Does. It does. Time flies when you're having fun. Ken Adams is the owner of Adams Design Construction in Madison. Always a pleasure, Ken.
Thank you so much.
And John Freiberger, Wisconsin registered home inspector who specializes in the evaluation of older structures. He's the founder of Freiberger and Associates in Fitchburg, Wisconsin. And just a reminder that we do have the CORE event link up on Facebook. Thanks to Carl, our on-air producer, for putting that up there. Coming up tomorrow at 11, it's time for Garden Talk. Patty Nagai is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. We'll talk about planting for fall crops and keeping that garden productive for as long as possible. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is the Ideas Network.